Yes, probably.
Brilliant. It's the same. What the alternative to the wage system would be?
That's the question, comrade. Well, you know, I would like, you know, any speakers for us.
Well,
could you repeat the question?
Well, the question is, of course, that we've avoided what the alternative to capitalism is, or what the alternative is to a wages system. And I don't know whether I've been in the same room or not, but we've gone to a great deal of trouble of pointing out that what we were considering and what socialism would be like, which we consider to be the kind of society to replace capitalism, is a wageless, moneyless form of society where, to put it quickly or briefly, the whole of society would give according to their ability and take according to their need. That is the usual quick answer to the question of what socialism would be like as against what capitalism would be like. And the point at issue, of course, is that we pointed out that capitalism itself is only something which is part of an historical phase, a part of a way in which society organises itself because of certain features. In this instance, the breakdown of feudal relationships, the establishment of manufacturing of industry and so on, industrial factory manufacture, and the expropriation of the people from the land, the peasant class, and the making of a free wage labour, free force of wage labour, and so on. This was necessary in order to, historically, to develop the means of production and distribution and to produce mental concepts amongst men and women of the working class with the realisation that there could be a different kind of society, that the irrationality of the present society could be organised, reorganised on a more rational basis. And we consider that the more rational basis is where the whole of the means of production and distribution of wealth is commonly owned by the whole of society, where there is no profited class and no propertyless class. And so we envisage a system of society which, as I said, consists of no wage labour, where human beings give of their ability and take according to their need. Such a society can only come about, as the previous speakers pointed out, when the majority of people, the majority of the working class, are socialists, want socialism, understand what it means, and are prepared to capture political power, to engage in political activity for the purpose of capturing political power, dispossessing the capitalist class, the wealth and the ownership of wealth, and making it, declaring it the common ownership of all mankind. In short, a new kind of society where the whole of the social relationships would be quite different to those of today, where the means of production and distribution of wealth would take place without the need for exchange relationships which take place under capitalism. This is one of the slight differences of the... Well, it isn't the slight difference. It's one of the differences between the Socialist Party of Great Britain and the Labour Party. When the Labour Party talks about the establishment of common ownership of the means of production, distribution and exchange, they are in fact defining what we mean by a capitalist society, an exchange society where goods and services are produced merely for profit on a market, and this entails the exchange relationships that go with it. So the kind of society we're talking about is a socialist society, which is the abolition of the wages society, which is the present society you're living under now.
Did you want to come back?
Yeah, the problem is, on the subject, there's going to be a redistribution of resources. I think you said that there's going to be an abundance of resources due to technical improvement. There's going to be a need for redistribution of resources, let's say, from north to south, i.e. from Europe to Africa or whereabouts. It's going to be a redistribution. So there's got to be a state to control that redistribution. How is this redistribution going to occur? And the great worry, from my point of view, is that we're going to become slaves of that state. What's the point of becoming slaves of a new state?
We would see it as a technical question, this question of distributing goods from one part of the country to another part of the country. But I mean, it's still a technical question that you can solve using modern technology, using computer systems, using the communication networks that we can use that stretch across the globe. I don't see why a state would need to be set up to implement that policy. I mean, it's something that you feed in information to and you get information out of.
Who controls the system?
The ineffectiveness of much of the public sector in this country is because those methods of distribution within the welfare state, health service, education, etc., are very ineffective. How would you produce a system that would be more effective?
Well, it's a question of not me producing a system, but of people designing a system. You talk about the welfare system, you talk about the education system, the national health system. None of these systems are really designed for people. They're designed to patch up, to modify, and to get people to work in this system. I mean, what we're talking about is producing a social system which people design themselves. And you create an education system in which people decide themselves what the content of their education is going to be. You design a health system which just caters for sick people.
He's saying the people's going to redistribute it, but who's going to redistribute it?
Can I just say this? That this question of when we're talking about the changeover from a society to a socialist society, we are assuming that certain changes have taken place within capitalism, within the society in which we live, in order that we can, on the one hand, conceive of a new society, and on the other hand, we will be faced with using the existing technology, the existing institutions, providing they're not the institutions of coercion, which the capitalist class use to maintain its interest. We're talking about institutions such as health institutions, if the Tory party leave any left. We're talking about those institutions which have developed within capitalism, which are capable of further extension and further development. There's no doubt about it that medical care will be an essential part of a socialist society. There's no doubt about it that distribution of wealth from one part of the world to another will be an important part of society, under a socialist society. There's no doubt about it that problems with which we're faced, such as the production of food, the use of land, which at the present moment is left to lie fallow and so on, the use of the sea in terms of development of food in the sea, and all these sort of aspects, these problems with which we're faced today, and which is solved merely by producing the necessities of life for a market in order to obtain a profit, under socialism they will be used for the purpose of producing for use and use only. And the people that will organise themselves within that society are the people that are organising themselves within this kind of society. There will be people. There will be members of the of society who are delegated by the majority of us, where the dissemination of knowledge is completely permeates into all aspects of society, where the idea of democracy, which is completely misused or abused today, will be fully extended, where everybody will be in a complete picture or in the picture of what is taking place within society, and you will elect your various delegates, you will develop various expertise and so on in order to put this sort of thing into effect. So it's an extension on the one hand of what we have today. We can only take over the means of production which we are left with, the remnants of it which are left by capitalism, and we will extend those and further those, not in the interest of profit, but the interest of the satisfaction of human needs.
Yes,
I'd just like to ask the question in the middle of the room. Spoke about the failure of the public sector in satisfying money, and so the problems that public sector meet in solving these needs that would arise.
Do you have any literature or pamphlets on the subject of the implications of organisation in a socialist world? how things might be arranged, how distribution might take place. Do you know anything like that?
I think could we have just the party has just.
Perhaps our friend might like to, as you know, in the break, have a look and you know, because you can't. I appreciate you can't say everything in 10 minutes or quarter an hour, and the implications seem to me to be vast. And probably the written word, you know, spelled out in a pamphlet, might be a better source of such information.
We have enough, I think.
Thank you.
A pamphlet under in our preparation, comrade. Yeah. I hope that will be ready soon. Comrade, we have it here. But what happened? No one has a question or contribution? Yes, go.
My concerns, whilst I sympathise with the shift to socialism, I can see where we are today. It's this transition from one to the other. I appreciate the development through democratic means of people, more people wanting the socialist state. But it's still got, if you like, it is the mechanics of the transfer. And I'm concerned about how that will come about. What sort of problems that people foresee involving arising at that critical phase? Will it have to be involved destruction? Will it be a slow evolution? Do you not foresee rather heavy problems, i.e. groups of people rather reluctant to give up what they present in control?
That's what
will come up to
about
that.
Yeah.
The point is that all previous revolutions in history have largely been the revolutions of minorities. They have tended to replace one ruling minority with another. See that whether it's France in 1789 or, for that matter, Russia in 1917. All previous social revolutions follow that pattern. What we're talking about, the one revolution which has not yet taken place, we're talking about a world revolution which is, for the first time ever, the revolution of the majority, where you have this vast working class majority, about 90% of the world's population, once and for all, throwing off its back any kind of parasite, whether it's of the aristocratic variety or the modern manufacturing employer variety. So that's the first point that's different about what we're saying. In that sense, some of the problems you might be hinting at don't quite arise, because we're envisaging a situation where you really do start to have a majority of people who understand the change that's needed and are ready to effect it. But as for the mechanics of this, you're talking basically about growth. What we want to see is a situation where more and more people start to join the socialist movement. It's as simple as that, really. Now, you might well ask, well, you know, what grounds have we got for thinking this is happening? Well, we're growing steadily. Not nearly fast enough, admittedly. We're growing steadily. Why do we think we're going to start to grow faster? Well, the fact is, capitalist society produces more problems than the clock ticks seconds. Capitalist society, which we have at the moment, is riddled with contradictions. Not just obvious ones, like the difference between someone starving to death on the one hand and a butter mountain on the other. That's a contradiction, but it's riddled with other contradictions.
I don't know if you want to carry on, but you already sort of answered my question. You're going back to where we started, because awareness of the problems that we have today. I mean, I'm aware of those, and I'm aware of what you're saying in the future state. It is just this transition. What just appears to be saying is that by the time the revolutionary side of that comes about, then sympathies will be so widespread that it will not be a big up people. But it could be given the technological advances that we have for destroying the whole thing. And I think that those sort of instruments will be used by those in control to subdue.
Well, I think what will happen there is that as the movement grows larger and larger, the kind of safeguard, if you like, that starts to be used to prevent the kind of, not just upheaval, because obviously it is an upheaval, but the kind of sort of tragic destruction that you're perhaps hinting at, the kind of safeguard rests in the fact that as this majority builds up, it extends its influence. I don't mean influence in a sort of some kind of parliamentary sense, but I mean social influence through every feature of social life, in every area of production. In other words, let me give you a couple of examples. Where, as our movement grows, obviously there will be more and more socialists, for example, in the fire service, in hospitals, or what have you. And in that sense, socialists who have entirely rejected capitalism in all of its forms will be in a position within a given industry to draw up practical proposals for how that industry must be geared to satisfying human needs. Socialist workers in one industry or another can do that. And in that sense, that allows you to effect a more smooth transition, if you like. Once we reach that point where we have got a majority, we'd have had plenty of opportunity in the build-up to actually find ways of how implementing socialist production. But on the other hand, you have the problem of the state the whole time, the capitalist state, which is obviously oppressive and violent, and it has the full force, the full sanction of the majority at the moment behind it, by and large. And there again, there's a safeguard, which is that as the socialist movement grows, we contest that state. We contest elections at every level we're able to. And the purpose of contesting elections is not because we've got any illusions about the supposed profundity of that democracy. We recognise that the Houses of Parliament are hardly the embodiment of real social democracy in the world. But on the other hand, we intend to, and we already do, contest every election we can, simply because that is part of the democratic, smooth transition in which you build up a majority and you transform this society. Does that begin to answer your point?
Just one point on that. I don't know if Clifford has covered that really, but we don't see the revolution as a single event. We see it as a process that's taking place, and the process is taking place now. It's a social process. Absolutely. It's a social revolution.
Just a case of how far along how far through the process you've actually looked back. It's easy to see it from this end, and it's easy to see what the objectives are, but if you look at it long-term strategically, as it were, what happens down the road a bit, or whether you've actually looked at that, or whether you said, well, we'll play something and get to it. Yeah, right. That's sort of area where you get problems where, because you have strong national boundaries and defence of the same, it's inferred that people in different geographical locations in the world are enemies of a particular geographical location. You see situations in which governments justify destroying other people in other countries in order to retain what they have within their own regime. So if you don't have a reasonably balanced development of social regimes in different geographical regions, then you're going to run the risk of one particular group destroying another particular group in the same way that you justify doing something somewhere else because it's in order to defend us that you've got to go and do that. So unless you get a reasonable balance of social development in all areas across the globe before you get to this great direction, that you're going to have a problem with this. Yeah. As far as how far from where you looked at it.
It relates to one of the points I've made earlier, which was that socialism is very much an idea for today, and the fact that we've got satellites, global telecommunications, etc., means that the spread of socialist ideas will be that much easier. And
so it's one of the biggest dilemmas I think the capitalist system has, to try to retain the balance when you've got these wonderful technological advances and communications, which we've never had before.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the problems the capitalist system has, certainly.
I only just want to say with regards to the relationship or the situation, the reality of today, is that a great deal of the sort of what you term the sort of development of ideas and so on necessary to establish a socialist society, this breakdown of national barriers and these sort of things are in the process of being destroyed anyway by capitalism itself. In the early days, we had this problem, early socialists, on the question of the small section of the Western world which was engaged in industrial activity, even as against such large countries as Russia, where the existence of a working class as such was non-existent, really. And this question arose as to, how would you get over this problem where you'd got socialism or the growth of socialist knowledge within a particular country and nowhere else in the world? And it's becoming more and more evident that that question no longer is a starter, but for the simple reason that capitalism is doing a great many of these things for us, that it's opening up means of communication, it's opening up trade throughout the world. the whole system of society throughout the world is becoming a capitalist system. Wage labour is becoming rife. It's becoming the prevalent mode of exchange of labour power and so on.
Because if they get the people who control the capitalist world and get their act together, they could just develop a global capitalist system.
These are working people, though. The people that you're talking about that, you know, run the capitalist system are in fact workers, and they're no more immune to those ideas than anyone else. Socialist ideas, you know, why are they going to stick to some sort of ridiculous nationalist ideas when socialist ideas are, you know, being fed to them through the media as well? You know, why should they accept these old nationalist ideals which clearly don't stand in their interests?
Well, as I say, if they keep getting their act together as far as controlling the system, then you can dictate what goes through those channels of communication. I mean, just because you have a transmitter and a receiver, that doesn't necessarily mean that people know, you know, what's going on at the other end. It depends what you put.
You can pick up 350 channels with a satellite.
Thanks, Comrade. Thank you. Yes, Comrade. Hi.
Good, Comrade Chairman. I think that our friend here in the front, they've got to be cognizant of a certain state of affairs, if I can put it that way. The politicians usually separate all of these processes up into material conditions and ideological conditions. But we recognize, of course, that all of these factors, all of these things are material conditions. But what our friend has got to realise is this, that never before in the world's history has there been such an integration of the world upon a basis of the ability to apply modern technology and produce a superabundance of wealth. At no other time has that occurred. And moreover, it hasn't up until now occurred within capitalist society either. But at the present time, there is no shadow of a doubt that the technology that capitalism has produced is capable of producing a superabundance of wealth in every degree. However, the one thing which is lacking, and the one thing that we concentrate upon, is the consciousness of the working class, which of course is developed by the contradictions of capitalism, but it also has to be a consciousness emanating from the individual as well. Because mankind changes history. History doesn't change of its own accord. It doesn't proceed of its own accord, as it were. Social changes are affected by human beings. Consequently, what we're saying is this, that the technique of production and the technique required for a system of society based upon production for use and cooperation in production, the ability for people to take from society what they need and give to society what they're capable of doing, is there. What we have to try and do is to determine that the ideology, the ideas which capitalism engenders are developed on the part of the whole of the working class. This is the problem. Now, we take the view that despite all of the contradictions, all of the going of the working class into blind alleys and all that kind of thing, that the working class is capable of understanding socialism. And when you've got a majority of people that understand socialism, then it becomes simple. I mean, we hear this business about things that can't happen overnight. But if you've got a combination of material conditions as far as production, etc., is concerned, and the will to change into a socialist society, then it can change overnight. And if you've got the majority of people
that come to that conclusion, then socialism is possible. So consequently, you've got to look at this also on a worldwide basis. You can't imagine, it's unimaginable to suggest that in a highly industrialized area, a geographical area, that socialist ideology will be developed, and in other highly industrialized areas, it won't. There will obviously be a uniformity of development because capitalism itself is uniform. But the stress is laid upon individuals. Socialism is not going to happen out of the blue. It's not going to happen on its own. It's going to happen when we and thousands and millions of other people decide that it's going to happen. So that's the position as I see it, and that's the position as the Socialist Party of Great Britain sees it. But what is lacking is consciousness on the part of the working class.
Let's go there, Eddie.
I'd like to touch upon the point raised earlier that if only the capitalists got their act together, they might be able to forestall our getting our act together and maintain their system as a united capitalist class, as distinct from the present rivalry between capitalist blocks and states and groupings. But that is rather presupposing something which isn't the nature of the beast. Where it comes to spoils and thieves' kitchens, there is an inevitable tendency to quarrel over the spoil. And I think the kind of basis that we work for, of working class unity, may not, certainly doesn't exist now, but working class unity, I think, is a perfectly valid concept, because the recognition of victims, of the need for common action to overcome the problem that makes them victims, isn't something that's happened so far, but it's a perfectly valid objective to aim for. But to suppose capitalists whose position is based upon their legalized robbery of the majority and the carving up and splitting up of the spoil, assume that they will happily and rationally agree to do it on some sound basis and in collaboration with each other, doesn't tally with the actual experience or likely trends. Even in recent years, where it would seem there are fairly strong reasons to think that if the European capitalist groups, which in the past have been faced with such rivalries between each other, were to submerge their sectional interests, and as a united European capitalist class face the vast power over markets and resources of the American and Russian super states, the European entity of capitalists could stand up to that scale of development. But all the signs seem to be that they're very disinclined to reach that even regional getting their act together, to use the phrase that our friend used. So I wouldn't say that I would say the notion of capitalist unity in that sense against the threat of socialism is particularly likely to occur. And it's also a consideration that the very openness of their action need to be would probably press over to the majority of workers who may not still fully understand what they're up against, what a clear-cut enemy we have. So I think it's an unreal fear on his part.
Thanks, Corbett.
Could I ask a question? I noticed that one visitor declared that in all probability there would need to be a state in order to organise the distribution of resources and products to administer. And another visitor, whilst quite sympathetic to the ideas that you're putting, expressed his understanding and sympathy by referring to the socialist state, which he was all in favour of. Could one of the speakers deal with this problem? Because earlier on, the speakers were saying that the socialist world, in a socialist world, there would be no state. So could one of the speakers explain the function of the state at present, whether a state machine would be necessary to organise the production and distribution, and whether it would be correct to refer to a socialist state?
That's the way.
Well, I should have thought, Comrade Chairman, that Comrade Cox, who is a socialist, of course, might be able to help out himself.
I don't want to hold the show.
The cover is blown. Yes.
That's one comment, please. Comment to that, please. Yeah.
Well, I agree that it's best on in general to let people speak for themselves, but I take the point. And in relation to this first point about there'll have to be a state because of this need to distribute resources and so on, I think very briefly that it would probably be a mistake to assume that because you've got a large-scale operation, which is what I think you were saying, that therefore a state will arise. The operation of distributing resources from north to south and so on, as you say, may be a very large job, but the fact that it's going to need the cooperation of millions of people and it's going to need a lot of coordination and it's going to need administrators delegated by the rest of us to organise things, none of this means that because it's large-scale, it will therefore have to involve a state. If by state you agree with me that we're talking about an oppressive elite, as I think you do, because you said you're frightened of that, you don't want to see socialism degenerate into a situation where you have a state, in other words, a bureaucracy, a power within society which can dominate over the rest of the population. I simply don't accept that because you have a large-scale operation to organise, it must therefore degenerate into that. There's one safeguard and one safeguard alone against the socialist society degenerating into that kind of thing, and that lies in the heads of each one of us, in our own brain and our ability to think, because that's the only safeguard. If in a socialist society people who have been delegated to simply perform the day-to-day task of organisation of something take it upon themselves for some obscure reason to become a new ruling elite, and to go back to the days of war and poverty and starvation and conflict for some obscure reason, insist on becoming a new ruling class, well, they will do if the rest of us let them. It's as simple as that. So what you're back to, in fact, is the argument about consciousness or awareness. What we're really arguing about there is it or is it not possible to have a majority of people in the world sufficiently aware in their thinking to prevent a ruling class from climbing back up on their backs? Is it possible or not? If you say that a socialist society will degenerate into a class-ridden situation where you have the state rulers and the rest of us, then what you would in fact be saying, and I'm sure you probably wouldn't want to say this, is that we're inherently incapable, that even though we might achieve this, that almost as soon as we've achieved it, we fall back again into this pathetic servile stance where we allow people to turn themselves into a new ruling group. I don't think that's the case. I think you can, as Democrats, set up a situation where the administration or the organisation of society is emphatically not a state, in the sense that it's not some kind of ruling elite, some power group. Instead, what it will be is organisers, administrators, distributors, and all the other functions. Some may appear more special than others in our eyes nowadays, but it's only because within capitalist society, some of these jobs are given special status. I think in a socialist society, we will learn to recognise that which is obviously the case, that the person who does the most menial task is in fact just as essential to human survival as the person who does the more wide-ranging or global sort of task.
Is there anyone left to add to it?
Can I just bring something into the discussion, which I think you should be all the time conscious of one thing when you're discussing the idea of socialism.
when he's discussing society generally anyway, you should be looking at the whole thing in its historical concept. In other words, when you think, if you go back to early primitive society, there was no need for a state there. Under these conditions, there was no such thing as private ownership, there was no such thing as property. But with the development of the productive forces, when it became possible to produce an abundance, when it became, not an abundance, but when it became possible to produce a surplus above the requirements of the producer, up to then, don't forget, the majority of the human race spent most of its time in busily in the hunting and gathering stage in searching for food. It was quite a development when mankind started to eat meat and found that it was getting a great deal of energy from something which from food which previously he'd been spending all his life in the gathering stage. But under these conditions, with the development of agriculture and the development of the husbandry of cattle and so on, it became possible for the whole of society was turned upside down. Here you've got a property-based society in which land and cattle and so on was owned by a minority. It enabled, for instance, the build-up of armed forces. In the period of Greece, for instance, it enabled scattered tribes to be brought together under so that they were a larger force and able to develop cities, enabled to develop an army and so on in order to protect this surplus wealth which was being produced. I mean, for the whole of history, the human race has been producing a surplus above its requirements, and the whole of the struggles that have been going on either between classes or between rival groups, between invasion of barbarians and so on under the period of the growth of societies like Greece and Rome, the development of the bringing of the tribes together, and the development of a state, the coercive forces of the state, one, the judiciary, the legal means of protecting private property and establishing the rights of private property to a minority in society. The development of the army in order to protect property, in order to fight and protect the walled cities, which were, of course, the beginning of civilization, the Greek word civic, civilization. And incidentally, the idea of justice was first of all founded by these early primitive societies. The goddess of justice came from the idea that everything was, distributed amongst everybody, and it was a common property of all mankind. And, you know, to suggest that the idea of justice came up with the development of civilization is quite wrong. The idea of justice in that sense is, of course, the justice for a minority to own wealth, just in the same way that the freedom within a capitalist society is freedom, of course, for the capitalist class to have its own markets and so on. So unless you're looking at it historically, unless you're seeing that the development of the state relates to a particular form of society, and when we're talking about a society of common ownership made possible because of the development of the productive forces, there's no need for a state. We will abolish the state along with abolishing capitalist society.
One thing I have learned, I think, from that, and I think there was a set reference in it, not to use the word state, because I just
didn't
some
words.
Thanks.
Yeah, I
thought so. Loose talk can cost lives, comrade.
Yes,
comrade.
Yes.
Well,
thank you, comrade. Sorry, thank you. I have attention, please. Please, you know. Thanks, comrade. Yes, comrade.
Yeah, briefly, I'd like to try and ask a question about Magnus' speech. It's not so much the state I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is the concept of nation states, in that there is this illusion of reality that there are nation states now. I'd like to ask the question, address the question to one of the speakers here, that it's not getting people to think in terms of the nationality or whatever, but how can the Socialist Party deal with the real nation states, if you can call them that, which are big multinational businesses? You know, like Exxon and Shell and the giant motor companies. What they do is they direct their enterprise into parts of the globe where the wage rates are the cheapest. There is no real ideological commitment to any country. You're not dealing with countries anymore. You're dealing with vast, large businesses that do as they please. How are you going to deal with that? How are you going to deal with the, you know, how are you going to deal with, get across the message that you've got to deal with these type of concepts, these type of problems, rather than people assume that they belong to a country?
Well, their
please come here now. I shall give you time now. That's enough. Yes, come.
Oh, it's true.
Do
you want to make your point anyway, then I'll come in after that, if you like.
Mm. Oh, just trying to say that the basis on which these multinationals work is a capitalist precept, that their interest is profit, and they couldn't give a toss about ideology. Their interest is money and profit.
They're not interested, as you said, in national commitments. They're only interested in profit commitments. But when you ask the question, well, how are we going to get this across and so on? Well, a lot of workers who work in these multinationals, which by definition employ a lot of labour because they're that big. So we're talking about thousands and thousands of employees. And of course, they know only too well. They don't need us to tell them. People who work for a multinational, they know what it's all about. They know, they associate that multinational as their boss. And they have a direct relationship with it. So I don't think we've got a great problem there. But there is a bit of a myth about this which creeps in at times, that in other words, well, what I want to say is that the old idea of the nation state, as you put it, you know, the state with its national army and so on, hasn't really totally been replaced by these. Although you're right, they're much more powerful and bigger than some states. I mean, give you one example. The turnover of nettles now is bigger than the Swiss government's budget. And Switzerland is by no means an insignificant state. So you're quite right in that sense. But on the other hand, well, Switzerland's a bad example, in fact, militarily, but most countries have a fully militarised army. And well, yeah, but I suppose Switzerland has other claims to make about that, neutrality and so on. But, I mean, the point is that multinational companies don't have armies of any sort. They rely upon armies to defend their wealth, but they don't actually have armies. So what I'm saying is that however big a multinational grows, and however big some of them have grown very large, they haven't reached a point where they can challenge the political power which resides within a national state. They've never actually challenged that and wouldn't want to. They wouldn't see it as their function or role. When they need an army to defend some of their investments, they'll go to one of the national armies of the world in the old-fashioned nation states to do that for them. They won't actually challenge it themselves.
How multinational are they? I've heard the phrase a lot, and I think I know what's meant. But when I actually look at multinationals, they don't seem all that multi. You don't see a multinational which happens to be a multi, Finnish, South African, and Brazilian multinational. They do tend, do they not, to be American-based
or British
in a number of other places, or Japanese-based, and one or two groupings with a major base in one or other of the main industrial powers.
They're multinational
in their operations, and they clearly will hop around for particular activities to avoid tax structures, and hop around for particular activities to avoid pollution legislation here, or strong trade unions there, or import controls or export controls and so on. They shrewdly do that, but their actual control and shareholdings and so on tend to be centred on the major economic powers and major industrial powers, and they are made, even though they use these methods of avoiding tax payment if they can and so on, they still are huge contributors to the tax systems of the countries in which they operate, and they look as taxpayers to the governments of those countries to do what taxpayers expect governments to do, and that is provide value for money, armies, judges, and what have you, prisons and so on, to see that their profits remain in their hands.
Come on,
no, I did.
Okay. That's what I'm coming. Especially, do you have anything to say? You know,
yes.
That's what I'm coming. One, do you have anything
to say comment.
I just want to ask a following question.
Okay.
That is this. Where is the international bankers, like the IFF and other people like this, who do exercise a tremendous influence on governments? If the Labour Party would have come here to let you open up the Labour Party, the Guinea had to go to the IMF. And the IMF is a consortium of international bankers. And they can dictate to certain governments if they want a loan. No, to any. So,
I'm getting a mortgage.
This is one of the that might be for these multinationals to do and can do, and often in a position to bring pressure to bear on certain governments. You know, how to.
Thanks, Robert. Is anyone if you want to add anything?
Can I just say a few of your thoughts occur to me, which some of you may or may not be interested in. And they are these. In every avenue, every aspect of capitalist domination, all their power and their influence, control, their ability to maneuver and their ability to sink differences when it suits them and to exaggerate them when it suits them. All of this is not done actually by the capitalists. I mean, they're on their yacht, in touch by satellite telephone with their stockbroker, and that's as near as they get to administering their system. It's all done by us. It's us that issues the lies and the propaganda. It's us that calls upon the army of wage slaves, if we're managers, personnel directors or something, personnel managers. It's us that issue all the bump and all the material and the advertising. It's us that does the research in Taiwan to see whether their safety regulations are so poor that a higher rate of exploitation can take place because you don't have to spend money on extraction fans and guards for the machinery. I mean, they're not. They don't go down to some horrible bloody suburb of the capital of Taiwan to see if it's a good place to build a factory. We do that. I mean, not me personally, because I'm not a factory designer. But my fellow worker does. I mean, I can point sort of metaphorically out of that window and say, he does it, she does it, they do it, we do it. It all rests on, strangely enough, the whole bloody edifice rests on our acquiescence, our willingness to carry them on our bloody shoulder from birth to death. We do everything for them. We wipe their asses for them. And it's important to get clear in our minds that since all workers are bombarded by the problems and the difficulties, even high salary levels, managerial levels, can get the sack, be made redundant, find the industry going into decline, finding all their knowledge and expertise being thrown on the scrap heap, just the same as a factory worker or anybody else. Since all workers are subject to the same pressures, the same stresses, the same fears, the same poverty at times, then all workers are likely to react in a given way, which is sod this for a laugh, let's get this bloody show out and ours on the road. Because the Socialist Party, even a small sample though it is, doesn't consist solely of low-paid production workers. It consists of a fairly wide spectrum of people who, in all their experience and different levels of income and education, have all come to the conclusion that this system stinks and needs to be replaced. Now, it would be a very brave individual to declare from his or her own limited personal experience that whilst you lot have done it, you've seen the light, all these other workers that are suffering just the same, equally helping to support capitalism, are somehow not going to be affected by the constant bombardment of capitalism. Somehow they're going to be isolated. Somehow the multinational companies are going to isolate their employees from the effects of capitalism. Somehow the capitalist class, in a concerted, united effort, is going to be able to cocoon all their employees and say and prevent them from hearing, watching the telly, reading the newspapers, isolate them from the effects of capitalism. Fortunately for us, since they can't do that, then also fortunately for us and for the future of the world of socialism, each one of them, in his or her own way, comes to the conclusion that it's not worth supporting any longer, and that at that stage it's a cinch. You know, I mean, it's almost a walkover.
Any more contribution? Any more question? What happened?
What are you happy with?
Well, in our especially if the visitors has any comment, any contribution, any question, especially this comment. Well, in that case, you know, I request, you know, the speakers to sum up their argument, comment.
Well, I don't think there's any need in summing up any argument, Comrade Chairman, mainly because this is a meeting which is a public meeting, and anybody that wishes to engage in conversation and so on have that right. Which, as far as I'm concerned, I've said as much as I can in the short period of time that I had at my disposal. All right, if you want me to briefly sum up, it is... there's always that danger if you have somebody to sum up. You know, unless you're a really excellent after dinner speaker.
get an extension.
You tend to go on. As a matter of fact, I was getting a bit worried earlier on in the evening when I thought the meeting was getting a bit like the EC. Have you never been to one of our executive committee meetings when if you take a simple thing like a pen, within about 5 minutes, they're full into their full stride. They can tell you how that pen came into existence. It's historical development from simple rudiments of expression, art expression and so on. They can go on and explain to you how it has any relationship to socialism in the modern world. And this can all be as a result of dropping your pencil when we were discussing something quite different from a pencil. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the chairman has briefly mentioned to you the literature which the party's got. And this is the thing which you should be doing, is reading the literature we've got. Trying to develop, if you can, a method of a critique of existing society from an historical perspective. This is what you've got to do. You've got to continually look at it in relationship to its previous history, in relationship to the development of existing society, to the extent of what it can do under a completely different society with completely different social relationships to those that exist under capitalism. A relationship where human beings relate to common ownership, and by doing that, organise themselves, organise the means of production on a sane and rational basis. In other words, I think it was Marcuse that said, one of the problems with capitalist society is that it rationalised irrationality. We're discussing a society where for the first time in the history of mankind, we will rationally organise the means of production and distribution of wealth to the benefit of all mankind.
Well, you know, thanks for the speaker. Thanks for all comrades and visitors.